From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a longtime local broadcaster announced plans to leave the airwaves. We could be talking about our colleague Ellen Biendutihofer, who hosted Need to Know while reporting on special projects for WXXI for years. We could be talking about 13WM's Jennifer Johnson, who concluded her on-air career last week. We could be talking about Norma Holland, who ended her 23 years on 13WM TV 2 weeks ago. Well, this hour, we're going to talk about these retirements from the industry, in a sense. We're going to look at how broadcasting is changing. We'll talk about appointment viewing, and we want to hear from listeners about whether you still watch shows or broadcasts at a set time. I mean, we know you watch the news hour every night. I'm talking beyond that. We're talking about, are you setting your DVR? Is DVR still a thing? Are you setting your DVR for appointment viewing for Thursday night at 8, for Wednesday night at 9? Are you watching newscasts at a set time at 11 p.m., 6 p.m., 4 a.m., whatever the case may be? Boy, I remember those days. And we're going to talk about the hopes for journalism as an industry going forward, particularly broadcast, with our colleagues and friends. And it's great to see Ellen Biendutihofer back with us in studio.
Oh, it's good to be back.
You look the same.
Oh, good. That's a good thing, right?
Yeah. It hasn't been that long. It hasn't been that long.
It's been 2 weeks, maybe 3 months.
How long has it been for you?
It's been almost 2 months. Yeah.
July.
What? Yeah. July.
Oh, wow.
July, indeed. That's right.
Oh, goodness. Freedom.
Well, not really.
I continued working.
I know.
You didn't retire.
That's
Helen,
exactly. Like I did not. Yeah. No.
And Norma Holland is a longtime journalist who is moving into a different career now. And it's great to see you as well. And it's been less than 2 weeks for you.
Yes. Do I look already more well rested?
Oh, my gosh. You're glowing.
Right.
Really miss it. You really miss it already.
Sweet. Thank you, friend. What's that?
You miss it like gout.
Oh,
oh my God.
Well, you do have a way with words, Evan. I'm going to let you go on the record of saying that. I miss my colleagues immensely. I really do.
I do too. And you know what? I actually mean by that. The hours are really hard.
The hours are rough.
You're
yes.
What time were you waking up every morning?
You know, I'm not going to lie to you. The standard answer I would give is 2 a.m. However, with a a toddler and a small child, it could be anywhere from midnight to 2. So there were times I'd get up at midnight and I would just be up. I'm up. So
something happened to me one time back when I was working with you. There was one day and I don't know if this may be a very gendered comment, but I don't know if this would work for women. I slept through every alarm.
Yeah.
And Mike DiGiorgio, the executive producer, finally got a hold of me at 4:31 a.m.
Yeah.
I was on the air at 4:57.
I remember that.
Wow.
26 minutes from actual wake-up to shave, suit, foundation, bronzer,
mm-hmm.
sitting
the bronzer.
On
he
the
needed
set.
It. I'm going to tell you the truth. It is not a gendered comment. It happened to every single one of us on that show.
But could you get out of bed at 4:31 and be on the air at 4:57?
I'm going to be honest with you. If I showered the night before, yes, I could do it. And that's exactly what happened to me. The one time that I got up at 4:30, my Uncle Hector, who was visiting us at the time, I was so nervous and so shaky, he had to drive me to work.
Oh.
At 4:35, I finally got dressed, and we were out the door, and I was on the set at 4:58.
No one was the wiser.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm putting mm-hmm. eyeliner on in the car. I'm like, oh, my God, I'll be late for my job.
So that's what I mean when I say you miss it like gout. Nobody likes that schedule. And, Helen, that's why I joke, freedom, because you have a little bit more autonomy. But you know what? XXI is a great place to be. I'm very, very happy to be here. And I know you had a great career here. When did you get here?
September of 2010.
2010.
Right,
wow.
Right. So. I know. Megan sent me a text asking. I said, are you trying to age me? And she said, well, Evan thought 6 years. And I'm like, oh, no, much longer than that. So September of 2010.
Thanks a lot, Megan Mack.
That's amazing. Wow.
I misunderestimated. So it was almost 9 years for you.
Right, yeah.
So you are very much still in journalism.
Yes.
And I want you to tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now.
Sure. So I would say in the early summer, I saw this post about Solutions Journalism Network. So this is an organization based in New York City, and they've got I mean, they've got journalists around the country that they're connected with, and they look at reporting on not just problems, but let's talk about the solutions, possibilities around problems and around the globe. So I highly respect this organization, and I see this post about, hey, you know, we are taking on this project called Complicating the Narratives, name likely to change. And I read a little bit about it, and I thought to myself initially, this is great. I can't wait to hear who does this work. This is so needed in journalism. Delete. And I deleted the email, and that was it. And that, you know, you get that gut, that thing just like speaks to you and says, no, 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 pull that back out of the trash, read it again. And I thought, this, I have to do this. So they commissioned research from Amanda Ripley, who's a freelance reporter. She does a lot of work with The Atlantic. And she spent several months looking into the work of conflict mediators and how journalists can learn from the strategies and techniques that will be used in conflict mediation when it comes to covering divisive issues. And so she released this essay, which was absolutely phenomenal, listed a number of strategies that journalists can incorporate when talking about polarizing and divisive topics. And now they decided, I guess the outpouring of, you know, the response that they got from journalists around the world was incredible. And they essentially were telling SJN, Solutions Journalism Network, we need more. We want training. We want help. What can we do to change our approach? And so they decided we have to do something, and they launched this project, and I'm now managing the project.
That's brilliant.
I love the approach of taking that kind of question on, well, how would, you know, a mediator actually try to understand, quote unquote, the sides, or, you know, what divides people and where those lines are and how they're drawn, because they seem so entrenched right now.
Mm-hmm.
And people may not like me saying this, but, you know, if we ever put together, and we do this all the time, but we put together panels of people who are small business owners, people who, suburban white women, we did one time, people who voted for the president, mm-hmm. we will inevitably hear from progressives who are like, we know, we don't need to understand them anymore. You know, they're this way. And I'm going, look, if you view this, and progressives kind of tend to view this president as like a national emergency, and there's 63 million people who voted for the national emergency, you might want to take some time to try to understand it. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to agree or like it.
Exactly.
But we, you know, we're a little bit at this point where we're like, well, get in your corner because everyone else is bad. And I think that the approach that you're describing is a little bit more humanizing and a little bit better at trying to at least break down those barriers. And it's not soft, and it's not both sidesism, and it's not everyone's right and everyone's wrong. But I think it's really interesting. So how does the work happen? Tell me about what's going on right now.
So we're developing it right now. I mean, so this is, and it, we're very transparent in the fact that this is, we are experimenting. We are not saying that this is the way to do it, but journalists, talk to us. What do you need? Like, when you read this piece and when you think about how you cover conflict, does anything resonate with you in terms of what she's presenting? And if it does, what do you need to learn how to do an interview in a different way, right? Because a number of the journalists that we trained with, they said, in J school, I never even learned how to do an interview.
No,
because
I agree.
It's about listening. We have to listen better, listen more. It's about asking questions that really get to the core of somebody's motivations. And Amanda Ripley says this, it's not about covering positions, but it's motivations. And when you do that, you then generate a sense of curiosity, and that we need that as journalists. And we want that in the public, in our audience as well. So right now I'm doing a listening tour, so to speak. And so I want to hear from journalists and that will tell me, you know, this is what we want. This is what we need. And then from that, we are talking to community leaders. And this is happening all over. But I'm focusing on Rochester, of course, because this is home for me. And I hope the two of you will be a part of
You're going to call us?
She's looking at me and I'm like,
right now. Are you going to be able to stay local-ish?
I am. Yeah. So local.
So for people wondering, you're not going anywhere.
No,
you're staying in Rochester.
I'm staying in Rochester.
So awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Staying in Rochester and then traveling, because we want to train newsrooms around the country. We want to work with communities that are willing to work with their local news outlets about a divisive issue that they want to figure out a way to tackle together. So those will be one of our beacon projects that we're doing. But really, we're building this from the ground up. So it's, okay, we're doing conflict mediation training. We've got all this research. We're listening to journalists. Now let's create a protocol, right? Let's create this training, this curriculum that we can take to newsrooms around the country.
That's brilliant. I'm sitting here just so excited, just listening to her, thinking,
right person,
you know,
right
I'm,
job,
I'm
right?
Already, yes, and right now.
Right now.
Right now. I can tell you that, and, you know, Evan, the way you mentioned it, you know, the way you said, you know, this is not just, you know, they have one side, they have another side. It's very easy to stick your head in the sand about the issues that are facing us today because they are so complex.
Right.
And so for you to say, no, we can shine a light on those things that make us uncomfortable,
yes,
in a way that respects and humanizes both sides. I think that's so brilliant. And you would be and are, I believe, the perfect person to do that.
Oh,
and
thank you,
it's great that you can do that. Because a lot of newsrooms, and Evan, you know this, look, they are understaffed.
Yeah.
They are hustling to try and get stories and content on the air. You know, they may not have the time to devote to this, but boy, do they need it.
And that's what we have to figure out, too, is because those are the questions that we're being asked. How do we do this when we're, especially for broadcasters? We're on a deadline.
Yeah.
We're out covering breaking news. Does this even work for breaking news? Are there things that we can take from that and apply to a breaking news story? Maybe not doing all six strategies, but maybe there's one thing that we can do, one approach that we can change.
Journalists are hungry for training.
I think so. And that is what has been so pleasantly surprising about this process, is that that's what I'm hearing.
They're hungry for training. You get into a day-to-day job and it becomes that, right?
Yeah.
And the creativity and the thoughtfulness,
yes,
can sometimes go by the wayside. So it's great to be reminded through training. And newsrooms, including our old newsroom, do offer training, which is great on a somewhat regular basis. But on this is revolutionary.
So let me kind of jump in and say, not only the general training that Norm was talking about, but a specific piece of that that Helene was talking about that I, for some reason, never really considered. We think about when students go to journalism school, mm-hmm, when journalists go off to conferences, what are they focusing on? What are the skills they're learning? You said something that I've never really thought about because it just doesn't come up, which is how to actually do an interview.
Right.
Well, that's the only thing I do. I mean, like, it's the only skill I have. And recently I was talking to some friends about, you know, everybody's thinking about their futures. And I said, you know, I actually, sounds sort of strange, but I want to be the best interviewer in the whole freaking country if I could. And I would love to be the person who people feel like they have to sit down with, because everyone's listening and they know they're going to get, you know, they're going to peel back beyond just sort of the surface level, and that there's going to be meaningful conversation. And I, you know, we work really hard on this craft here, but I've never thought about, well, what did I learn in school about interviewing? I've never thought, well, when I went to Pointer or another conference, this is how they trained me to interview. And every journalist has to end up doing either short form or long form interviews at some point.
Right.
But there isn't a whole lot of emphasis on this.
Not at all.
Yeah. And that's, so I applaud you for that. I think that's really great. Really great.
We do it on the fly, right? I mean, that's how we've learned to do it. And
it
then
is.
We watch others and we look at, okay, I watch Norma, I watch your craft, I watch your approach. And then I think to myself, okay, what can I learn from that and apply to myself? That's a many ways,
sure,
that we learn how to do it.
You watch other people and you think, oh,
right,
you know, but here's the thing. I've known people to say, I've already written the story in my head and I'm just going to go out and get the sound bites. I'm being honest.
Yeah.
To fit the narrative. And I'm thinking, mm-hmm, oh, come on, really? You're not giving this story a chance.
Not at all.
If you've already written it in your head. And so how do you interview people? Listen.
Exactly.
And I would rely a lot on my intuition. I would always put myself in the other person's seat.
Get on your microphone. You're a broadcaster.
I'd get. I don't want to be like, hello.
Yeah, I do. That's what I want.
I would sit, imagine, and this came about especially when I would interview the families of homicide victims, because I did a lot of crime reporting earlier in my career. And I'd go out and I'd knock on doors and I'd say, you know, can I please speak to you about your loved one? And I'd always imagine, how would you want to be treated? So there was
right.
a lot of that innate, how do I want to be treated,
right?
Right? And that's, and then I would, from that, I would then craft my questions.
Right.
I don't know if that's always necessarily the best approach either, but that's just how I did it. It was innate.
But I think that is because you're in the moment with that person. That's when you're there and they can sense that you're with them. They can feel that you're listening
to
them.
But not everybody takes the approach Norma's talking
about.
No, they
don't.
We've all seen it.
But I agree.
Yeah, we have.
But I agree with you. I think that it is the right, because she questioned, I don't know if this is the right way to do it, but I think that it is, because that's what helps to develop trust.
But you know what,
though? People can sense you're there with them in that space.
I used to fear that I was too soft, that I was being too soft on the person, that right now, But again, I would say, but wait a minute. But this person just lost their loved one. How am I supposed to be? You know, no, but I need the facts. Just the facts, ma'am. I couldn't do it. I had to go to bed and sleep at night. And so I'm not saying my approach was perfect.
No,
but it was the only way I knew how to interview people.
I'm going to just shout it out to two people. Norma Holland, Patrice Walsh are two of the top people that come to mind when I think of people in our community who have, during interviews that no one wants to have to do, have an unbelievable human touch because it is so authentic.
I learned from Patrice, though. I did. You talk about learning from people.
I'm with you on that. But there isn't a whole lot of training in how to actually conduct interviews, how to interview public officials.
Right.
They actually don't do a whole lot of that in J school. Can you believe that? They don't.
I can believe that. I mean, that's what's so shocking. And that's what needs to change. I mean, that's part of this work, too, is to how do we create a curriculum for J schools so that when you are teaching young people, this is the way to go about doing it. I mean, we need to change the whole curriculum when it comes to that as well.
Well, I don't know. You're looking at a guy where half the public officials in this town won't come on the show anymore, both parties. So maybe I'm not one to talk.
I don't know, Evan. Maybe you're doing something right.
Well, yeah, because I'm such a fearsome animal.
You're divisive. You're polarizing, Evan.
Oh, yes.
I had a boss tell me that. You're polarizing, Norma. And I remember thinking, what does that mean? Is that a good thing? Did you just insult me?
You got called polarizing? Okay. All right.
So honey, I could write a book.
I know. I have to hear the context.
So let's do this. Yeah. So let's do this here. You're both, you know, out of the business now. Helena is actually back in the building where she used to be employed. But just no one's listening, so you can just say whatever you want, Helen. I want to ask you.
That
makes me wonder, like, what is the most thing that someone said to you that you went, I cannot believe, polarizing to me is like high on the list because it's like, what does it actually say about me? You want milk toast?
I don't know. You know, when you're young and you are starting out in your career in broadcast, I mean, there's a lot of work that is done on you. And I say worked, but meaning there was a lot of input about how you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. How does your appearance, especially in journalism, broadcast journalism, your appearance, you meet with consultants, they look at your hair, they look at your makeup, they look at your clothes, they want you to be, I'm just gonna leave it at that. So there's that. But there's also a lot of attention paid to your delivery. How do you deliver the news, right? How do you use your voice, inflection and tone, da 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 da. And then they start looking at, you know, once they start doing research on you, how people view you, you know. And for better or for worse, people thought I was polarizing. Because I guess I was outspoken, and I always like to say looking back, I was a very confident young person, but it didn't mean that I didn't think I was being cocky, but there were people who thought I was because I was confident. I knew I could do the job. I was just doing it. You know, when you're young, you don't really think about what you're doing. No offense to young people, but you're not really thinking about, oh my gosh, right?
Yeah.
So I heard it all, honey.
But you were in, this was commercial news. So this is going to be a very different story than I would experience in public broadcasting. It's not the same because we didn't
have. But you were CBS before.
I did, but I was behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So that had not, I mean, it was just, sure. So what you dealt with in terms of level, I mean, that's an entirely different level than anything that I had ever experienced just because of the viewers. And I'll go back to commercial. It's different. It's just two different ways of doing news to a certain extent. And so that's why I just, And it's disheartening to hear polarizing, but you said the words, I was confident, and how they can, how viewers can then see that, and there are so many reasons. Why
I have
would
my
they
theories,
think those things?
Helen, when we're having lunch one day.
Oh, I already know.
I'm just going to get to the nitty-gritty
yes,
of what's
will.
Really going
yes,
on there.
Yes, we will, because I believe that your listeners are
you know
smart
exactly
enough to figure
that
out as
that.
Well.
Well, yeah, polarizing.
I don't think Sola doesn't know what I'm really scared.
Read between the lines.
Exactly.
Not to go too far in probably the direction that's been covered in a lot of different ways, but I think let's just be direct about something. The most shocking letter I ever got, and I get, and you're in broadcasting, you get emails, you get letters, you get phone calls all the time about people who don't like your work. You talk too quickly, that you've got some verbal tic that they don't like. I don't like the people you booked. You're not enough on my side. You need to call people out more for this. You hear that all the time. And by the way, that's okay. Because guess what? A lot of the criticism, to me, is actually pretty accurate. And a lot of the criticism, so if listeners ever want to email me, they're going to find that I usually will respond. And sometimes I will thank them because often they're correct. But some of it is nasty. Some of it is just really nasty. As a white male, They ain't nothing that compares to some of the stuff that I've seen women of color get in the industry. Mm-hmm. And we had, and this goes back years now, and I think I can say this without being directly referencing it, but there was an intern with Connections who did some really good, frankly, good on-air, hard-working on-air work for us, did a piece for us that we actually used on a Connections broadcast, and got the nastiest letter from a man who basically said, she sounds too black. And I think that at least with NPR, this is changing now. NPR is doing a better job. Public radio is doing a better job of basically saying, your authentic voice is your authentic voice. That doesn't mean we all can't do better in our public presentation, which might mean slow down your speech. That's for me. The late Carl Shuba used to do this pacing thing for me when I was going too fast to kind of slow me down. And that's good. And I still remember the late Carl Shuba in my head kind of slowing me down sometimes. Yeah. But it doesn't mean sound more white if you're not white. And I think that has changed. Do you think that has changed, Ellen?
I think that, and I don't mean to be the Debbie Downer of the group, I think we will always have that to a certain degree. I just think that's just how we are. I think as realistically optimistic as I am about this industry and our work and what we're doing, I do believe that we will always have that to a certain degree. Is it changing? Yes, I've seen it in the almost 9 years that I was here, and just listening to NPR and also PBS as well. I watch the NewsHour all the time. I'm seeing that change and I'm hearing that change, but it's just one of those things. We just deal with it. We have to recognize the fact that I think something like that will always exist.
Norma?
I don't know. I agree with Helene. Again, I'm not trying to be someone who is not optimistic, but honestly, I just growing up, look, we're going levels deep here, okay? You're talking to two biracial women.
Right.
Who grew up, you know, probably being accused of trying to sound white.
Mm-hmm.
This is my voice. This is my voice. I'm not sounding like anyone other than who I am, right? But growing up, I mean, you heard.
I mean,
it
you
all.
Do a wicked impersonation of your mother.
Oh, I do Lucy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's because that's Lucy's voice.
Lucy.
I can do Lucy's voice. Evan, she calls Evan Dawson the sausage man. She's calling Bob Evans. I'm like, Mom, it's Evan Dawson, not Bob. But you know, this is tough. This is tough for me. This is emotional for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I should be in therapy for all the things that people have said over the years. I really should. But I think I developed a very hard exterior. Maybe it'll come out years from now. I don't know. Maybe I'll write a book and people will think, who is that? I didn't know you felt like that, Norman. No, I worked with wonderful people who nurtured who I am. They did. Was the public always kind? No, many times they were not. Many times they were not. But many times they were great. And they allowed me to be who I am. But I'm with Helene when I think that, yes, journalists of color will always have to, I'm going to say it, they have to work harder. They're going to have to work twice as hard. They are.
And I think that it could change if we could look around our newsrooms around the country and see an accurate representation of our country in newsrooms.
Mm.
Because if we can see that, then I think that what you brought up, like, will this change? Yeah, I think that we could see the scale start to change just a little bit. But we need an accurate representation of our country and our newsrooms. And we don't have that. And we know that. I mean, I know you've talked about that before. And I don't need to go down that trail again. But that's the problem. I mean, I think that's a major part of the problem.
Yeah, I agree. We need more faces we need more voices of people that, and I don't mean, again, not how you speak, but I just think we need more experience. We need people of different backgrounds to enrich our environments. And I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear people, hey, what you're trying to, no, look. I want my daughters to see someone who looks like them or even can relate to their backgrounds. Do you know what I'm saying? And especially after having kids, I think about this a lot, right?
Yeah.
Who are my children watching?
Mm-hmm.
Who do they listen to? I don't think it's enough for them to just see it in their family. they need to see it on the air.
I got accused
in the media they consume.
Yeah, I got accused on Friday. I made an offhand remark at the end of a conversation with four local comedians, and one of the people in comedy is a woman of color, and there was a lot of talk about later in the hour about sometimes people of color in mostly white comedy audiences feeling like, wow, like what happens to them when, how they feel when racially charged jokes, racist jokes are being told. And then there was a lot of back and forth. And I just said, look, as the white guy with the microphone, there's enough of us. I'm going to let the woman of color close the hour, because often women of color have not been given a microphone in this country. And this guy sends me a, you're just pandering. That was typical liberal stuff. You know, we don't, oh, come on. You know, like this NPR virtue signaling. And I'm like, that is not. That's just reality. Why is this so hard for people? I'm a white guy. There's enough of us with microphones. The fact that I have this microphone in this job is a tremendous responsibility. Mm-hmm. Tremendous responsibility to recognize that and what that means. And to make sure that I'm aware and helping with some of the redress for that.
You make people uncomfortable when you say that, though.
But that's just being honest. That is not virtue signaling. I have probably, at times, I said if sometimes I veer toward empathy or maybe even virtue signaled in the past. Because, look, I'm human. But that was not a case of it. That was just honest. And what you talk about, women of color in particular, but people of color having to work twice as hard, I'd like to think that's not going to be the case generations from now. But... you know, it probably will.
I hope it's not, but I think that that's where we are right now. And that's the truth. And that's perhaps an uncomfortable truth mm-hmm. for some people to accept.
Right.
But it is what I grew up being told and it, by my own family, not by others outside of the family. But, you know, you will have to work hard, twice as hard, to be respected. That's the truth.
Let's after our only break of the hour, we're going to come back and we're going to move in different directions in terms of how our guests see appointment viewing in the broadcast landscape, what the expectations are in terms of how things are changing and whether that's good or bad for local journalism. I think local journalism is always facing challenges, but we'll have a conversation about where we go next with that. And I'm really enjoying having two of my good friends here with us here in studio. Norma Holland, a longtime journalist at Wham TV, 13 Wham, who finally changed course a couple of weeks ago. Ellen Biendutihofer, a longtime journalist at WXXI News, who is very much still in journalism and is going to do some great work for our community and our country. But let's get that break, and we'll come right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on The Next Connections. When talking about poverty in Rochester, we often hear about heavily funded programs, but there are a number of local grassroots efforts that make a difference in the community. We'll hear from some of the people behind those programs about what they're doing and the impact their work is having. In our second hour, Fashion Week of Rochester is back, and we preview next month's events with organizers and designers. The annual event benefits homeless children and teens at the Center for Youth. We're back. We should... one of these days, we're just going to let things roll through the break.
Are you sure you want that?
When it gets really real. Actually, Rob Braden, who saves my backside so often, one of these days, he's just going to let it roll through break just as a way of a little bit of revenge, Rob's revenge one of these days. But before we move in different directions, I will just ask both of you, because the remark was made that we could have had a lot more to say on these subjects. If there's anything more you want to add, speak now or forever hold your peace on this. Is it better to move in different directions?
Let's move on. Let's do it.
You want to move on?
Yeah.
So when we use the phrase appointment viewing, some listeners have asked as well, what we're talking about is just the old style. It's amazing how that sounds now.
Back in the olden days.
Exactly. Seinfeld's on at 8 o'clock on Thursday nights, and SVU or whatever the hot thing that people watch. Is on Tuesday night. That means that's appointment viewing. If you want to watch, okay, how about this? The Good Place. Let's pick a show that's awesome. The Good Place, I think, is appointment viewing. That's on, I think, Thursday nights at 9 on NBC, starting this fall. What am I working for them? But the bottom line is appointment viewing is when you're not streaming or binging something. You actually have to wait till Thursday night to watch Lost. Or you have to wait You have to wait till 11 p.m. to watch the late news, or you have to watch a noon newscast or a morning newscast or a 6 p.m. news or 6 p.m. on Thursday nights or 8 p.m. on Thursday nights, whatever the case may be. most of us that, at least in our age cohort, are changing. Some of the older listeners are probably less in the mode of change. That's just what the research says. And people who are younger than us barely know what appointment viewing is at all. What do you think about where we're going with this? And is it, you know, I mean, what broadcasting has to do with this? Sure. Are people waiting to get the news from broadcast at a certain time?
Norma's shaking her head no, and I agree, because I can tell you, I don't do appointment viewing. I mean, I tune in if I need to hear something or I want to see something. I will go straight to my phone, find the news app that I want, and I will watch exactly what I want. And I mean, I don't even think about, that sounds terrible from someone who had, you know, an 8 o'clock program, you know, on Thursday nights, but I know that a lot of people would tune in afterwards. You can go online and watch the show, or you can watch on Sunday if you want to. So I just have not been in that mindset of doing that, I would say, in the last maybe 8 years, but more so in recent years. I just can't even fathom tuning into something at a set time at all.
I think the Game of Thrones maybe was like the last time that I was like, you know, not that I even could, because I had to go to bed at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, because it was on at 9 o'clock on HBO.
On Sunday nights? When was
that?
Yeah,
Sunday nights at 9. And but when I was off on Monday, I would definitely tune in on Sunday night. I had to know what was going to happen to young Bran, you know? We do it to some degree, but no, by and large, and I'll tell you what, in the last 2 weeks since I've been off, I say away from the desk, I'm going on the app. Right. I'm on the app checking to see what the latest headlines
are.
Right. I want to know. I mean, I catch the 5 sometimes at night.
5 p.m.
Yep. You know, because, you know, we're home and we're cooking and I've got the TV on, or in the morning when we're getting dressed and getting ready to get the girls out the door. But yeah, it's all the app. I'm on. But think about it. We craft products and content for the web.
Right.
Everything we do that airs on TV is online.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, younger adult consumers don't want to wait for a certain time to be informed about certain things. There's an expectation of close to immediacy, but it's really more when they want it.
That's it.
I want
That's
it now.
It. That's
it's
it.
A, you know, like Veruca Salt, you know?
Yeah, and so
I want it now.
I do think in terms of commercial television news, morning is going to have the most staying power, because people are always going to be getting up,
yes,
getting
right.
kids ready to go, getting ready for work, making coffee. And if they want to check
that out,
they can do
that. I want to hear the forecast. I want to know what the headlines are.
But you go throughout the day, I'm surprised that there's still an 11 p.m. news at all. And that's not to denigrate, by the way, because I love the work that my colleagues in commercial television news
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
Often I really do, and appreciate the hard work that goes into it. It's just changed so much. And
I think it depends on where you are in your life, though, too.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. I agree.
Are you watching commercial news at night?
No. Not at night, never. And again, if I want it, it's on the app. But I do in the morning. Every morning, I have commercial news on as I'm getting ready.
Do you know what's so funny? Is you're saying that. I'm thinking, my husband, at 6:30, will watch the newscast. He'll watch news. Like after he watches the national news is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
After the local news is done, he'll sit and watch.
The evening news.
The evening news.
Yeah.
Still. And he's, you know.
I mean, he ought to be waiting for news hour. But yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody's perfect. I love you, Matt, man. I'm going to get Rich in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Very good, sir. Go ahead.
And talking about appointment television, I've gotten to the point that even the shows that I like, if they're on and I'm watching TV, I won't even watch them. I want them to record. I don't even watch any live, outside of sports or maybe news, I don't think I watch live TV anymore. I always record so I can fast forward, get past commercials, stop it when I want to stop it, or sit down at my convenience. So I have taken it to the level of I won't even watch it if it's there, if I like it.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That
That's
is really
point.
Interesting,
yeah.
Rich.
You're
thank
right.
you. I mean, I was even thinking about a show I like called Shite's Creek. That's what I'm going to have to pronounce.
Yeah,
it.
I was
going
to say, because I know you're not
saying
not
that
the right.
show. Yeah, that's not the show.
My sister is in love with that
say
show.
Say the name.
That's a different show.
I can't believe how much I like that show. But to Rich's point, even if I had whatever the network's, I don't even know what it's on, Pop or some Canadian network. Even if I had that during the seasons it's on, I would rather just have it on a streaming service and just sort of binge it on the weekend.
Right.
So I think
I
Rich's point is really solid there. Like,
that's interesting.
Wow, look how much we've changed already.
If I do watch a newscast as it's happening, I sometimes want to rewind. I'll be like, what did he say? a lot of times I watch news with subtitles, captioning
on. Because
it's so noisy with children in the background.
Yeah.
But sometimes I want to rewind it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, I can't because it's live.
But I think Rich is right about sports. When it comes to sports, I don't think that that's the one time that I am watching that
live. Live.
Because you're a part of the action then.
Yes.
And then you're on Twitter and you're responding. You're seeing what people are saying.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
It's always spoilers. You can't go on Twitter or any social media and not have your game ruined.
Right.
You know?
Michael says, it used to be that every day we had a must-see TV show like Lost on Wednesday, Big Bang on Thursday, Battlestar Galactica on Friday.
Fun.
But now I'm down to three network shows. Young Sheldon.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Friended by God.
Oh, yeah.
And Blue Bloods.
Oh, all good ones. Yeah. Those are all CBS shows.
Wait a minute.
Blue Bloods or Blue Hairs?
No,
I think it was like Tom Selleck.
Blue Hairs. Blue Bloods. Blue Bloods on Friday.
Wait a minute. Okay. Was Downton Abbey on
PBS?
Yeah, and that was appointment viewing.
That was appointment viewing.
Oh my gosh, Downton Abbey was like one of the late examples of that. Absolutely.
Another episode. We used to sing the song.
But to your point, you said leading up to this, how does the news? How do we kind of work around that? And for appointment viewing with Downton Abbey, WXXI did have a program on. Like they made sure that they had a way to support it to keep the audience there, to build on that. And that's something that I think we have to think about doing in a different way. If people want to go to an app or they want to go and they want to stream something, how do we create content then that continues to live? So often we go out on a story, you do an interview, you're done, we cut up the interview for the story, but there's much more that can be there. And I think we can use some of those missing pieces that we never shared in a story that we did as a way to continue to help a story to live, and that we can do that online to keep viewers engaged.
Absolutely. There's stuff. Sometimes what we used to do was we would go and we'd record an interview. And like you said, we'd use the portions that we would use for on air, but then we would run the whole interview we would put everything we did online.
And I think
so you could see the interview process.
Exactly.
And people could actually see the whole interview.
Exactly.
So if there was question as to, well, what did they mean by that?
Right.
And context, I mean, it was all there.
And what was missing.
Yeah.
And when you do that, that's one of those things they say when you
value added content.
Oh yeah, and that helps to build trust too, and they get to see the whole process.
Yes. I think the more you can remove the veil, so to speak,
that's it.
People like that.
Yeah.
I know I like that.
I do too.
You know?
I do too.
Behind the scenes.
Right.
And that's why things like Instagram are so powerful, because you can do now with Facebook stories.
Mm-hmm.
Journalists are using those platforms in a different way to literally do the behind the scenes stuff so that they can add value to their brand or to the station's brand or to the story.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I like that personally.
Here's a data point from Cindy. She emails, ever since we got a digital antenna, we don't even pay for cable TV. Streaming services are not something we choose to include in our spending. I get news all day on NPR, Daily Paper, online via New York Times, Washington Post, and even the Channel 8 local and national news. I watch shows as they are broadcast. I am 62. That's from Cindy. Thank you, Cindy. And that's a good, wide, diverse menu of options there. I think there's something generational here.
She's choosing not to be inundated with information all day. Let's be honest. When you have access to everything all at once, you have to self-regulate.
Yes, you do.
There's like a whole generation of figuring out how to do that. You're like, people be like, I got 1,000 channels on my cable box. Like, how much time do you have in your day?
What was the name of that? Who wrote that song, 57 Channels and Nothing On? That was a lyric in a song. I can't remember. 57 channels. I'm like, 57? That's nothing.
57 channels and nothing on. You're like, oh, you got the basic package, did you?
That would be me.
You must have one of those heavy TVs. My son does not believe that TVs used to be heavy.
Oh, that's funny.
Like, yes, they used to be massive.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it'd take like a team of three weightlifters move them. And you'd have back problems.
There,
and if you drop them, they might actually work.
There was
carpeting. That's how you made TVs work. You hit the side of them.
That's right.
There was
carpeting. It's a different era.
Wood grain.
Oh, I had the wood grain. Oh,
yeah, we had that. It was a piece of furniture.
Like a dresser.
I used to pledge dust that
thing.
What was
what was happening in the 1980s when station wagons and televisions had wood grain?
It was
wood paneling.
It was
happening there.
The feel of wood. It was rich.
It was warm.
Rich mahogany.
Rich mahogany.
Nice rich mahogony. Helen and Norma Holland both transitioned out of their longtime local broadcasting careers, and we're talking about the future of broadcast. And in some sense, what I hope you do, especially with young journalists, but I would do this right now, right here, to anybody listening who's under the age of 30. No offense if you're 30 and older, but I'm really curious to know what younger adults what they want out of a broadcast like Connections.
Yeah.
You know, we are noon to two. We are live. We have tens of thousands of people who listen every week, and we are gratified more than you can possibly imagine at that. But everything is changing, and a lot of people access us via podcast, via you know, via the app, you know, at different times.
Yeah.
But I want to try to always be ahead. The last thing you want to do is be Kodak going, well, we invented digital, but listen, keep that quiet, because this film thing, it's got legs, I tell you, legs. And you're going, and then 10 years later, they wake up going, wow, we got beat by digital. Huh. You know, we don't want to be that. So I'd love to hear from especially younger listeners what they want out of this in terms of accessibility, reach, timing.
Content. What do you want to see?
Exactly.
I'm telling you, there is a market for stuff we're not even thinking of covering that is out there. You got people in town who are saying, you know, why aren't you covering this? Why aren't you covering that? You've got to contact your local reporting staff and tell them, your local station, your local radio station, your local newspaper. What do you want to see? You know, what stories? And research is done on all this stuff. But, you know, for years it was, well, they want to see the weather. Come on, really? Is that it? That's all they care to see is the weather and sports scores and the lotto numbers? I'm serious, really? Give people a little more credit than that. What compelling information? If you're a parent, what kind of stories do you want to see? If you're, again, it's all where you are in life. I feel like it's so seasonal.
But when you say, you know, think about all the things that have to go into covering council meetings, the county legislature, these things that seem mundane but are vital to the workings of a society. And we have smaller staffs, newspapers in particular, but television too. You know, that's, again, that's why I'm so happy with the public broadcast model. We're holding strong here, but it's hard to do everything you want to do. Well, here's Bob who writes to say, and Bob, I understand this concern, but this kind of goes to the question of what do you have staff to do? Bob writes and says, my biggest gripe with the local news in the last few years is using limited valuable news time to show the most dramatic or funny or silly videos around the country or around the world that has nothing to do with local issues or matters at all. I'm with you, Bob. That's a little bit like saying we got too much dessert. Where's the broccoli? Mm-hmm. But all the problem is you fired all the broccoli growers. And, you know, or half of them. And so
newscasts are trying to, I know in the morning, we're trying to be as well-rounded as possible. We're trying to feed you a balanced diet here.
And when I say Bob fired him, by the way, I don't mean Channel 13 or whatever.
Oh, yeah, no, no,
I mean
no,
viewers, not, people who don't want to pay for content.
Okay, right.
You know.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think TV stations are trying to do a lot. And, you know, and as the old saying goes, you know, sometimes, you know, we're going to please everybody all the time. Sometimes we're not going to please anybody, you know. But you still have to do that. You still have to be as balanced and well-rounded in your coverage of our community, because there is the good and there's the bad.
But speaking of balanced and well-rounded, let me read an email from a listener who I don't know him personally, but he writes with some frequency and he's a super smart guy and I always appreciate it. But this time I think I disagree. Benjamin says, network news has become far too skewed for me. I much prefer the Cronkite form of news, allowing me to make my own opinion. And I don't really watch live TV at all anymore. Walter Cronkite was a liberal whose coverage was reflective of his values. I don't understand why that's all that controversial. He covered the Vietnam War pretty faithfully to what was happening, and that impacted what the public perception was.
But back then, I mean, think about it. There weren't as many voices.
And I worship the guy, too, by the way.
And
but this is someone who is also referred to as the most trusted man.
Yes.
I know.
In the news. So,
but people talk about him like he was some sort of a robot with no actual bias or interest in the outcomes of events.
And
we are human.
We all have that. Exactly. We all have those. I was just reading about that today. Like, every journalist, we have to understand that we come in with a bias. We have our own issues that we're dealing with, and we apply those to the stories that we're looking at, and we have to kind of step back and think about that before we dig into something and how we may feel about it based on personal experiences, history, and so on. But
you need to face that and be honest with yourself.
Yeah.
When you're a journalist, because
self-awareness
is so important.
There is a load of malarkey about you got to be objective. People are not objective.
Not true.
Human beings are
right.
not objective. What you can be is self-aware of your bias. And that self-awareness is vital.
It should push you, though, to get and hear from people you don't necessarily agree with.
And that's exactly what it should do.
It's harder to do that. It takes more time.
Right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's the other side. How do I then approach those people with
And yes, sometimes humanize.
I would like to think that we do that with everybody.
And there are listeners who will send me notes saying, you know, you should have really smacked down this caller or smacked down this opinion. And that's just not really what we do.
No, you were giving the person the space
Absolutely.
To be able to share why he or she may
I'm
have
I'm not
felt
the
like
arbiter on
right.
this program.
We're and not that, good at that, though, in our society, though.
But yes, I know. That people kind of want these broadcasters sort of take a side, be on my side.
Well.
And I was talking to somebody recently who took a debate class many years ago, and I love this idea. In the debate class, the first assignment was, you've got to come up with, I think it was a 5-page paper, arguing your side of whatever issue in life you are the most passionate about.
Uh-huh.
So what issue of your life matters to you the most? Social issues, political issues. Give me the most compelling 5 pages you can give. Argue the point. And students would be like, yes, I'm going to argue my point. I've been waiting my whole life to, because I'm passionate about this. And then he'd go, okay, the next assignment, now that you've handed that in. And this is the real assignment, because we're throwing this one out. You're writing a 5-page paper arguing the most cogent, persuasive case against what you just did.
Hmm.
And the students would go like, but I'm right.
Hmm.
I can't argue against this. I've spent my whole life building my opinion around this. I'm correct. And the teacher would say, if you do not write an honest, a faithful, honest, hardworking account of what you think the true points against your positions are, you're going to fail. And they would have to do that. I loved
that's a great lesson.
Self-awareness.
That's a great
really good.
I was reading about this, the American Press Institute. They said, before you cover a story, write a lead. Before doing any of your interviews, any research, just write the lead. And then when it's the end of the story and you've done all of your research and you've made contact with everybody, go back, then write a new lead and see how closely connected they are. If they're in alignment too much, that might mean that you didn't cover the story in as much depth as you should have.
Didn't learn as much.
Exactly. A very different lead.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
John writes to say a point that actually two different listeners have made this point in the last 10 minutes, which is fair. Walter Cronkite was a liberal, but with that said, you could still see a clear line between his reporting and his sharing thoughts or opinions. Today's news is more about agenda.
Mm-hmm.
John, I think that's actually probably fair. Walter Cronkite was a liberal. He did take pains to try to distinguish. And there are times I think people in broadcasting are sort of drinking their own Kool-Aid and not seeing that there is a line or that their view that they're not just right.
Mm-hmm.
And so one fun exercise, and this actually came based on, I was actually with another broadcaster who I will not name because they're not here, but was just with a small party. And one of their friends said, Evan, you know, it's always interesting listening to your show because people are, you know, you have people from different viewpoints and my mind actually changed recently. And she said to me, when's the last time your mind changed about anything? And I was like, that's easy.
That's a great question.
I said, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. For me, it's easy though, because I almost find myself painfully swayed by persuasive arguments on all sides. I could give you a list of what people would call 5 big issues where my mind has absolutely changed in recent years. And the listeners may or may not know that. But I love it when my mind changes because it means that I can still grow.
Well, you're elastic in your thinking. And I think, unfortunately, today, people are not as elastic.
They view it as
holding steady, digging
exactly.
in.
That weakness, that's a good way to put it.
It's strong to dig in and it's weak to change.
Right. Digging in is what you need to do. And, you know, keep that line in the sand and hold steady and hold hard and fast to it. But, you know, growth comes from changing your thoughts and changing your mind. Or at least softening a position or being able to even see the other side. We're just not good at that. We're really not. It's a virtue to be steadfast.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know. I think as I get older, I'm able to see and understand more than I could.
Gary writes to me and says, so you're a flip-flopper.
Maybe you'll smile. You'll never make anybody. That's the other thing.
That's
you want to please
kidding.
Everybody.
Be able to.
He's
you
kidding.
Will never do it. Come on, Gary.
Though, however, I do think the notion of the term flip-flopper, I think in politics it's fair for people who are cynically changing positions to try to suit a political moment, but I do think it's become conflated to say that anybody who's ever changed their mind based on evidence is a flip-flopper in politics, and I think that's harmful.
Yeah.
So All right, so now to our last couple minutes. We've gone a lot of different directions.
Yes,
here.
This is fun.
Hey, Norma Holland, what are you most excited about for the future now that you've changed what you do?
Flexibility in my schedule. I am so excited to be going to the Digital Hive, which is downtown. It's a digital marketing company that was formed 5 years ago by a good friend. You know him.
He's a great
Jeff
guy.
Jeff Knaus. He's brilliant and he's young and he's got great ideas. And I can't wait to have a more flexible schedule to be able to be with my girls. And you know what? I have so many interests. I've just realized I have so many things I want to do. I've never been able to do them. And I can't wait to be able to do it. I feel like the door is open and I'm running through it.
Ellen.
Good for you. That's great.
What are you most excited about?
Oh, boy. I think just hitting the ground running. I just want to, this work I've got, I'm on a year on this project and we've got the election coming up. And so it's no coincidence that the timing is in line with that. So mm-hmm. I just want to start working with journalists in a capacity I haven't been able to in the past. So just to be able to sit across from them and figure out what we can do, hopefully to help change the way we're covering things.
Timely. Wow.
I love that.
So awesome.
In the farewell video to you, by the way, I just want you to know, they got me, they used a clip of me saying that I knew that Norma was going to be a good friend after I was wounded. I'd been there for like a month, and Norma's like, I'm like, Norma's awesome. And then she came up to me one day, and she's like, I want to tell you something.
This should be good.
I love you, but... What's going on with your hair cannot continue.
Look, brother, you needed my my assistance.
You can't do
it. Because that part was way too hard.
It was a hard part. It was a consultant part. The consultants told me to do it.
See?
The consultants are usually wrong. The consultants are usually wrong, but it was a consultant part.
Call me insultants.
The insultants told me to do it. And I was like wounded about it. And then I realized it's the best advice ever. And I changed. And now I don't have much hair to begin with. But I did at the time. My hair used to be thick. And it was because of you. Telling it like it is.
I just, because I wanted
because you. Because you love somebody.
And let me rephrase. I said, you're a good looking man. Now cut that hair. I'm just saying.
And he listened. You listened, right?
I did listen.
Is he not
listen.
A handsome man?
See? Yes,
I
he
did
is.
Listen.
Yes.
What did I used to call you? The poor woman's
the part,
Maroon 5, what's the name?
Hey, David Griffin, Megan Mack, Rob Braden, the whole team here, thank you to everyone. And by the way, the part that they did not include was what I said was, you also say something that I love hearing a lot, which is I love you. And I love you, Norma Holland.
Well, I love you.
And it's great having you here. And Ellen, same deal. We love you.
Love you,
thank
too.
Thank you for the work
thank
that you
do. Number love
hey,
for you,
everyone.
Baby.
We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.
See you.